This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 11. Antarctica holds the majority of the world's ice and fresh water. It is critically important to the planet and is a mirror reflecting what we humans mean for the Earth. Nature's laboratory in the south reveals things like a record of the Earth's climate held in its 420,000-year-old ice core. What happens in Antarctica doesn't stay in Antarctica. That's an excerpt from a book that I'm going to talk about in this week's episode. It's called The Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning. It's a fantastic book, and I can't wait to tell you more. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. This week, I'm talking with Carol Devine, a Canadian writer, researcher, and activist with a focus on the environment, climate change, and glacier retreat. But before you get worried that this episode is going to get depressing, let me assure you that Carol takes the same tack as I do with Pure Green. She shares beautiful stories, often personal anecdotes, coupled with breathtaking imagery to communicate with others about these huge, scary problems, with the mind that only through beauty is one truly inspired to create change. Carol and I met briefly a couple of years ago. We spoke really briefly, but she handed me a postcard for her new book called The Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning, and I knew I had to know more. It was beautifully designed, and the subject was so compelling, I got in touch right away. We featured Carol in her new book a couple of times, and I'm delighted to be talking with her again now for the podcast. In the episode, Carol and I talk about her early fascination with the Antarctic and how she made her dream of visiting come true in a meaningful way. She spearheaded an organization of volunteers to travel there on a mission to clean up the debris that has collected as a result of global exploration and research. What she found there was life-changing and has in every way shaped who she is and what she does today. We talk of her book, which is stunningly beautiful, crafted in a way to emulate old polar exploration journals. Its first print run is sold out, but don't worry, it's going back to print under HarperCollins, so keep an eye out and definitely pick up a copy. It's so worth it. We also talk about her newest endeavor, which is a 10-year project involving Glacier Retreat and her daughter, Veronica, who is 9, or maybe she's now 10. As Carol puts it, as Veronica grows, the glaciers shrink. It's humbling, but the magic of seeing these majestic glaciers, this great endangered species, through the eyes of a child is truly magical. Carol feels as though perhaps she needs Veronica and her innocent insight to really actualize her project's true potential. Anyway, let's go to the interview so you can hear Carol talk about all of this in her own words. Here's Carol. All right, so Carol, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
So, Carol, you are an incredibly inspiring, multifaceted person. I mean, way more than I realized until I started researching for this interview, actually, despite having worked with you before. I mean, you've worked on countless projects and organizations, from humanitarian issues, you know, dealing with social justice and HIV, to leading and managing global projects on social environmental change or restoration, to writing and researching. I mean, you have several books, I mean, 3, I think, right? Or 4?
Contributed, yes.
Yeah. I mean, so honestly, your experiences are mind-boggling to me. I can only imagine what you've been exposed to throughout your career. Did you always know that you wanted to help and advocate for others? I mean, at what point did you know you wanted to take a special interest in the environment?
Well, I think from a young age, I had an interest in social justice. And then a big fear of mine when I was young, I actually wrote to the Prime Minister, who was Trudeau at the time, was nuclear war. So I think in each era, there's something we really worry about. And now I think that threat is still there, but I think we cannot ignore the climate crisis. But it came early, my sense of love and concern about the world and wanting to, you know, take that on as a profession.
Mm-hmm. So
I mean, I could talk to you about this for hours, but for this interview, there are two major things I would like to talk about. One being the book you co-authored with Wendy Chesler, The Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning, and the other being your 10-year project called Chasing Glaciers with Veronica. So let's start with the book, because I'm more familiar with it. I own a copy and have picked it up to peruse it many times. In fact, the spine is starting to creak. So before we jump in, tell me, when did your fascination with the Antarctic begin?
Well, I lived not in the Arctic, but the sub-Arctic, and I don't think I knew about Antarctica in detail, but I do remember looking at it on a globe. I do remember spinning it and looking at that bottom bit and saying, wow, that's a place I'd like to go to. And I was up at the more closer to the top bit. And then when after university, I thought, or in university, I thought, now is the time to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. So how did you finally make that dream of visiting come true?
Well, Antarctica isn't a big place for research or political activity. Well, it's a place dedicated to peace and science, but Canada doesn't have a big role there. But what was mm-hmm. happening when I was finishing university was Canada was involved in tourism there, and there was a group, Blythe & Company, who was taking, it was Marine Expeditions was one of the arms, was taking groups there at the time, and Margaret Atwood was going, and different people were going to the Antarctic. And I think then I thought, okay, here's my opportunity. So I contacted this company, and I said, how can I go? I want to go not just as a tourist, and, you know, it's an expensive place to go to. I want to go and work there. What can I do? And the gentleman, Sam Blythe, said, no, you can go later, but right now I see you like startups and have this interest in the environment. Can you start a small nonprofit that takes young people on eco-tours or education with tourism activities? And I thought, oh, no, I want to go to the Antarctic. But I spoke to some friends, and it seemed too good an opportunity to miss. And then I thought there's a way to work Antarctica in that with volunteerism and tourism.
Okay. So then once that happened, what was your objective for going? So you were working within this, you know, this idea of volunteerism, and so with specifically to the Antarctic, what was your objective?
Well, I had to find out a way. What is a way that we could be non-scientists and policymakers? What can general people who go to Antarctica do? And so I wrote letters to different research stations, and I look back now and I think they're kind of naive and beautiful letters saying, we are a group of volunteers with various skills who would like to contribute to Antarctica's good ecological state. In the spirit of the Antarctic Treaty says this place is dedicated to peace and science, and we will take care of the environment there. And, you know, looking back, it's great that I did it, because if I'd been more nervous about doing that or not having the right skills or not having the right people, I might not have done it. But the Polish station wrote back and said, please come and join us. So then we did a small pilot project, and people joined. People came. We had volunteers from Canada, the U.S. I wrote a press release and put it out in Canadian newspapers. This is the time of the fax, and sent it to the New York Times. And the beautiful part was when it got picked up and it said, come and have a cocktail in Antarctica, but help clean up. And people thought this was a good way to go to the Antarctic, but contribute a little bit as a civilian. So we got 54 people, and off we went. We needed a partner, and that was the Russian Antarctic Expedition the second year. The first year was the Polish station. And the second bigger project where we stayed on land was with the Russians. And the one thing they said we needed was to bring a cook. So that's where my colleague and friend Wendy Chesler came into it. And you know, because you've seen the book and the 42 recipes she collected in Antarctica.
Yes. Yeah. So your trip was formed specifically around the idea of cleaning up in the Antarctic, which I think is a funny thing for most people. They don't really think about the fact that there's waste and debris there.
Yeah, it's just so funny. You picture the perfect white continent that's the kind of last wilderness. But the thing about the ice is garbage doesn't melt. So up on the back of this Russian station, there was old fridges, there were large gas oil containers. So garbage doesn't melt, and if you don't take it away, it stays there, and it stays there, and it decomposes, and some of what decomposes is toxic. People were like, what are we going to pick up? And I spoke with my Russian colleagues. I said, so what garbage are we going to pick up? And they said, everything you can imagine. And truly, we picked up cigarette butts, you know, tin cans from larger abandoned fuel pipes. So some things were more recent refuse and some things were older. And it was a small, small dent in the amount of garbage that's still there. But it was a symbolic act. Plus, you know, a helicopter, Wendy spoke to a helicopter pilot that she was flying with in the Antarctic. And he said, you know, it's looking better where you've been, because over 3 months with about 50 volunteers, we did make a dent.
Of course, yeah. So this is mostly debris and waste that's from research expeditions mostly, or research stations?
Yeah, so some of it, small amount would have come from tourists, you know, not on purpose. There are really strict regulations, and people, I think, are very mindful when they're there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of it came from the researchers themselves and the logistics staff, and some of it was older. Some of it goes back to the 60s, the late 60s, when the bases came. And some of it, you know, the real lesson from this project and this year, you know, several year exploration about garbage and debris is, where is the right place for it?
Mm-hmm.
There's no right answers. There's no morally superior place for garbage. So some of it maybe is historic, right? That was interesting too, that we can decide as humans what's a valuable old hut in Antarctica and what can be taken down and taken away or reused, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember a part in the book where you're talking about picking up all these old nails, you know? And so I mean, there is definitely that historical element for sure. So then once you had all the waste, what did you do with it?
So it was an interesting and even challenging part of the whole negotiation is, where does it go? Because as I said earlier, where is the right place for it? Who's going to dispose of it properly? And who can take it properly? So with the first year with the Poles, they sent back research materials, which was also great that we could use this, you know, ship space that we negotiated to bring with the tourists. To also take some research materials back. Some of it's heavy. So some of the garbage went back to Poland, such as a tractor, and whether they retrograded it there or not. I know some of it went back to Poland, kind of returned to sender, and some of it was disposed in Argentina. And same with the second year. Some of it would have gone back to Russia and some of it to Argentina.
Okay. What a remarkable thing. So in your book, you write as well that Antarctica must be heaven just turned upside down. I mean, it's obvious that Antarctica made an impression on you. I mean, you formed much of your career around that. But what was it like when you first laid eyes on that landscape? I mean, what thoughts went through your head? I can't even imagine. And assuming that most of us will not ever go there, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I'm smiling right now because I'm thinking about waking up in the morning and going outside and, you know, the captain had said, you're going to start seeing icebergs tomorrow. And I got up really early and I went outside and it was still, there weren't many people out. It was chilly. And I just stood on the deck of the big icebreaker and there was a huge iceberg. And I remember thinking, I feel like I've entered another planet, which in a way, you know, with 1% of the world population going there, you are kind of going to the moon, much more accessible. But I remember feeling extremely lucky and extremely alive and really minute. It was, you know, kind of a cosmic moment where you feel so tiny because everywhere you look is water. And you know that there's still a ways to go before you get to land from Argentina.
Mm-hmm. And then the colors. I mean, it's funny because there are two people in my life that I know that have really intimate relations with Antarctica, which is such a funny thing. And one of the other person, you being one, is Rob Stimson, who's a photographer. And I mean, oh my goodness, the landscapes that he brings back from there just blow me away. I mean, the colors, it's otherworldly, like you said. There's just the quality of light does something to the colors.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
It's terrific. And I think what surprised us too, because we were in a part of Antarctica that's considered urbanized, which is funny. Mm. You don't picture that either. And it was multinational and there were people stopping in from different countries and planes. And it was really green. And I think that not just related to, you know, climate warming, but we were on like the little bit of non-glaciated part because of the time of the year we were there. And I think that surprised Wendy and me. And she's taken some beautiful pictures in the book of moss and So, you know, there's a lot of colors too in the land, not just the white, but of course a lot of white and blues.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Your second year, did you go back to the same spot, or did
no,
you?
No, different place, completely.
Right. Yeah, I remember those pictures of the moss in the book. It's just really beautiful. And your previous answer also reminded me. I think it was the astronaut Chris Hadfield who said that it was hard to go back to normal life on Earth after spending time in space. You know, your perspective just shifts in such a way that's hard to reconcile. And I somehow equate the Antarctic with space, which is funny because you said it's like the moon, you know, since it's a barren, otherworldly, exquisitely beautiful place. But it's nothing short of life-changing. I mean, how can it not be? So how was your life or state of mind changed after visiting Antarctica?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, immediately after, you know, we compared to, you know, what some people in the world are facing right now and what early Antarctic explorers faced, our hardships were few. But mm-hmm. When I came back, I felt really alive, and I felt, interestingly enough, I felt really kind of more deeply committed to doing international cooperation work there, because it's so international on the ships and when you get there, and even on the Russian base, they literally, you know, trade sugar with the Chileans and the Uruguayans and help each other in a pinch with large machinery. And I remember being on a beach and there were people from five countries. And I remember thinking, you know, this is an experiment. This is humans saying, we're going to dedicate this continent. It's not, we can't take it for granted. It's not necessarily forever. We human beings from different countries have said, let's really use this place for peace and science to understand the world. So I remember thinking, if we can do it in this remote place, I'm going to keep doing it from Canada.
That's a really nice takeaway.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to dive into the book a little bit more now, but I just wanted to say as well that, I mean, I first met you at a show we were doing, the Green Living show in Toronto, and we were participating in that. And we spoke for literally probably less than 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But you handed me a postcard for your new book, and I was hooked. I mean, I mean, for me, it was about this subject, but also the design. I was really impressed. And later, when I looked you up, I knew that we had to work together. I mean, I loved your work and your ideas and just everything about it. But what I especially love about the Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning is that you've taken a similar approach as I have with Pure Green. I mean, you're tackling huge, like major issues that threaten the very survival of mankind, but rather than scare us all into hiding, you chose to tell a story from your own personal experiences and inspire through your words and through that breathtaking photography, which is what I try and do as well with Pure Green. I mean, I appreciate that so much. It fuels my resolve to protect and preserve way more than crippling fear, which is something I feel like the mass media sometimes just doesn't get. So at what point did you know that you wanted to compile your Antarctic endeavors into a book?
Well, I think early on when Wendy and I met, when I had this condition to bring a cook and I met Wendy, and the fact she was a visual artist and a chef and had been working on a project that involved Canadian recipes, I think early on there was an idea that this is going to be unique in the stories of the volunteers themselves and how they came about, and their diversity, you know, from a 14-year-old kid to an 80-year-old, or in her 70s, a woman from California who was an extra in movies, to a biologist from the States. I think we knew that there would be great stories in the experience in itself, but there was this, you know, amazing kind of two-for-one in Wendy, who's a terrific tree-planting chef and also a visual artist and photographer.
Oh, okay.
So I think we talked about it then, and then it took many years. Like, I don't know how long it took you to germinate Pure Green, but you know, it took time to think about what is this going to be. And if we had done our book right away after, it wouldn't have been what it is now. It would have, you know, it would have been a whole other project. But I think both of us are into storytelling, and we wanted to tell it in an encouraging way, because it's also the stories become more negative in ways since that time, because we were there in 1996. We know a lot more now. So I think, you know, I say the story started early, but, you know, it was through our life experience we decided to tell it years later.
Okay. But there was obviously that foresight there, because I mean, you've got the journal entries and all of that. I mean, it's so well executed. It's amazing that it happened, like, what, 12 years after? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah. And we had a great team who helped us with these elements. We didn't want it just to be a collage. We wanted it to be integrated. And it's fun, you know. It's like a soft sell on a serious story where you say, hey, check out this recipe, and then you go a bit deeper. You know? But I like what you said about how, you know, the sensibility and as the aesthetic and just beauty in itself, we have mm-hmm. to have beautiful images to juxtapose the really concerning true stories.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I believe that so deeply. So I mentioned the title of the book already, The Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning, and I'm sure you get a lot of raised eyebrows when you tell people about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the title of the book just basically revolves around the purpose of the trip and then the fact that you you incorporate the recipes as well.
Yeah.
It's lovely because it's a conversation starter right away, and I love that. So, but what was your goal for the book after it was published?
Just a funny note about the title. In a way, it sounds so kind of feminine and old school, like women.
It does.
Clean. But, you know, it's a real twist on that. It's saying, you know, we can do small things that contribute, and we should. Plus, you know, you can use cooking, you know, to take you places. Your kitchen can be somewhere very far away. But what motivated us? What was our purpose? Well, I think it's a way to tell the story of Antarctica through food. It was a way to engage people and then talk about, you know, it's more than just about Antarctica. Antarctica is a vehicle, and of course that's the focus of the book. But by having recipes from different cultures, it's little tidbits and into respect and interest, and also what are the interconnections with other cultures through food and how food sustains us and how, you know, we're running out of food. And so I think the purpose was to share our experience and let it be shed a little light on other topical and important issues to us. And as much of that is also, you know, the beauty and the really human moments that inspired us, and in the little historic tidbits too from previous explorers.
Right, which actually brings me to a question I wanted to ask you as well, or just bring up, because the book itself has an interesting format. It's partially a journalistic account of your travels written in the first person between you and Wendy, and then equally a recipe book. I mean, you mentioned before that Wendy was a camp cook, and the recipes are a chronicle of the meals that she created for the crew of researchers and volunteers. But it wasn't until later, while reading the book, and actually kind of wondering about the format a little, you know, how you came to that place. And I discovered that through reading the book that was actually very intentional, and I love it even more now. So, you know, can you tell us about why that format is special and relevant to an Antarctic expedition?
We didn't really know it so deeply at the time we started looking at the different elements for the book, but it was an intuition and a kind of awareness of polar journals. Like, we'd read, you know, some of the big names in polar exploration, from Ernest Shackleton to Robert Falcon Scott. And then I went to the Polar Institute, the Scott Polar Research Institute at Cambridge University, for 3 intense days. And it was awesome because, you know, we repeat history and we reflect history. And there were these journals from the first American woman, or the first woman in general, who lived on land in 1950s. And she, you know, had journal style. And then I found these polar books that had recipes and little vignettes and little drawings and funny bits and bits about the weather. So it's a very, very small genre, the polar journal, but it's what we were putting together.
And it's genius. It works out so well. I love it. Yeah, and you write as well, you know, that food is life, food is culture. It shaped old expeditions and shaped ours, and we're going to use it to tell you this story. So again, you know, it's introducing that lighter, more accessible angle to, you know, into really investigating the Antarctic and what's going on there. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that'd be like...
Do you have a favorite recipe in the book?
Well, Wendy's bread is, you know, part of the reason, secret reason I did the book was to get her bread recipe. I mean, she jokes that only you got to marry into family to get her recipes. Now I wonder how she thinks that just a friend on Friday posted on Facebook the custard, that she'd made. But, definitely I'm enjoying making some of them. And the bread is one. It's spectacular. But also the beet soup. It's so great in winter to have warm soup.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I know the photo of the bread is so amazing looking. You're just like, I could just imagine how that tastes. And then I had to laugh when I looked at the recipe. And I'm just like, how much does this make? And then I was relieved that it breaks it down.
Oh, yeah. And that was intentional because people would have told us, make really small quantities. But Wendy, I admire her stick-to-itiveness. She was like, no, we have to have the big recipes too, because there's value in making a lot. Hand it out, share it, freeze it, you know?
Yeah. I forget how much flour it calls for, but it's a lot. Yeah. Okay. So your first print run is now sold out.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's amazing. What was the response to the book once it was out?
It was terrific. And it was social media and word of mouth marketing. We don't have a machine behind us. It's my small publishing company that did it and partners with everyone who did the book and Wendy. And it was an experiment too. Also, we want to get this out there. We got to get this out there. And at the time we had an agent as well. But she agreed, look, do this kind of proof of concept. So we printed about 750. Some of the books were already committed. Because we did a kind of informal Kickstarter, and we're delighted that, people that we knew and people we didn't know started to say, I'll have one. And then it was gone. And we got some great articles and, thank you. You wrote about us before we were out too. So it was a bit of a strategy too to build some, let's see if there's interest. And it was clear there was interest, and not only in Canada, but we were covered in a Dutch paper. We were covered. The UK has such a historic story of Antarctica, as does Australia. So there's been interest there. So we're delighted that it'll come out again in May.
Right, but this time for the US market, maybe, right?
Well, yes, it's HarperCollins. Yeah. HarperCollins US picked it up.
And, amazing.
Harper Design. So it comes out May 5th, but it'll be available internationally.
Well, that's incredible. I'm so happy for that because, the book, for those who haven't seen it, and they will once it comes out again, because it's just, it's so beautifully designed and it really has a fantastic aesthetic and just, it's so interesting. It's not the kind of book that you sit down and read all in one go, but you pick up snippets and then you think about it and then you go back and it's just, I loved it. Okay, so I'm going to move on now. So through your writing and through my own reminiscing on the subject, I've come to think of the Antarctic and glaciers more generally as a legacy. It's one of the records we use to deduce the shaping of our planet, historically. And now it's become a sort of scorekeeping for humanity's environmental degradation of the Earth. And the nature of legacy is that we pass it on to our children. And you've done just that with your 10-year project called Chasing Glaciers with Veronica, who is your own daughter. I love that. I love how you call her Glacier Girl. She's just a superhero after my own heart. So can you tell us about that project? I can only imagine how important it is to you.
Yeah, well, it came about in a roundabout way, and it just started to settle down, in the last while, meaning I'm doing it. And it started with my husband and my son were going on a very male trip with their grandfather and his brother to the Galapagos. It was a very special trip for them. And, Veronica and I didn't have to go anywhere. But at that time, I got so interested in glacier retreat because, of course, the Western Antarctic ice sheet is in trouble, and every little bit of sea rise is a deep concern. And so I was just, really looking at the map. And as you say, thinking about ice ages and when was the last glaciation. And yes, glaciers move naturally, but what is going on? Greenland was in the news all the time. And then the terrific film, is it Chasing Ice? Now I'm using the same name. and so at the time that I was just thinking about, okay, what if Veronica and I are going to do that special? And I was planning a trip to Iceland to look at Vatnajökull, its big glacier. It takes up 8% of Iceland. It's Europe's biggest glacier. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to take Veronica with me. Mm-hmm. And And I pitched the story to a few publications because I thought, this is such an opportunity to see what she thinks. She was 9 years old. And what does she think about, you know, these stories? And, you know, anyone with or without kids cares about the future. But also to have insight into what kids think when you talk about it is really, you know, I was really grateful for that opportunity. So mm-hmm. she didn't really know what was happening, and I didn't either. The project wasn't a longer-term one then. It was just, let's go and do it. But it was remarkable. We had so much fun. We learned so much. And I found it devastatingly frightening, some of her comments, and also incredibly life-affirming.
Right. Yeah, like what would be an example of that?
So we were on this one beautiful glacier tongue. I can't even say it in Icelandic, although I knew it at one point. Svina is its short name. And our guide was so terrific, Helgi, and he was describing to us how he can see the glacier retreat because the movie Batman Beyond was being filmed there, or one of the Batman series. And on top of the glacier, where there was a rock face, they put in spikes so the actors could climb the rock. Well, now the spikes are up higher because the glacier is lower. There are these real-life examples. And so I asked him, I just put it to him, I want to kind of experience things on the spot. I don't want to do all the research. I want the stories to reveal themselves like that. So finally I said to him, before I went to Iceland, I didn't find out, okay, what's the prognosis? You know, they're like endangered species. And he goes, this one has maybe 50 years, 2048, this will be gone. And he wasn't talking about that glacier, but he was talking about like a glacier outlet. And I said to Veronica, in 2048, this will not be here. How do you feel? And she said, is that good or bad? And I loved her response because she was prepared for it to go either way, you know, not quick. It was that she wasn't sure what we were talking about. And the minute she clued in that this beautiful kind of glacier lagoon was going to be gone, she was like so sad and devastated, like losing a family member. And so I said to her, what do you want to do? And she said, well, I'm coming back. I'm going to come back and I'm going to work on a farm here. You know, it's not all over. It's, well, I'm going to come and see it again and I'm going to embrace it and be here now kind of thing.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's thinking about glaciers, it's just, I mean, my husband has climbed Kilimanjaro, which is diminishing so fast and similar. They'll say it'll be gone by 2030.
Yeah.
And I mean, the wonder of that experience will stay with him for life. But for me, when I think about glaciers, it brings up this deep rooted sadness, kind of like you're talking about, because I mean, I just feel it in the deepest part of my belly.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just, I mentioned before that I believe the pathway to change is found in inspiration and through beauty. And so how do you keep the message positive surrounding retreating glaciers and, you know, when the evidence is so overwhelmingly gloomy?
Oh, I mean, you know, that's a great question. I think I'm living that question now. I guess partly through meeting people and telling their stories in these places, like, What can we do now? Well, we can still do something, and we must. We know about, you know, living with less and no carbon is going to be essential to have alternatives. So I think, you know, how to not just give up. I think for years I was closing my eyes to it. I mean, I did my Antarctic work, you know, in the late 90s, and then, well, I went into global health, and then I totally clued in that the two are interrelated, earth health and global health. They're not separate pieces. And the more integrated we think, the better and the faster we do it. So I showed one friend, I did this little mock-up of pictures Veronica and I took, and he said, oh, the child's eyes view, there's a kind of, you know, gentle poetry in it. So, you know, it's an ode to the glaciers to talk about them and see them. And I realize again, like Antarctica, we're really lucky that we can do this. And it's a way of documenting. And maybe I'm doing it with Bronick because I'm chicken and I'm scared of being there alone. not scared of like falling in a crevasse, but, you know, I need the hopefulness. So.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I mean, it's funny because with kids, now that I have a daughter, it's like, when I think about stuff like this again, it's just like, oh, you know, like, oh my goodness, what does this mean for her life? But then with Veronica there, she doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
She's she's more interpreting it for what it is right now. And that's important too, because otherwise you can miss out on some of that beauty, I think.
And I think in history, that's why I love reading other people's journals and stories, because, you know, we're feeling so worried right now, and rightly so. It's just irrefutable what trouble the planet, and more so humans on the planet, are in. At the same time, you know, reading other journals, you know, there was, you know, devastation of the wars, and there were other ice ages. And I guess maybe I'm an optimist or completely out to lunch, but I think, you know, we have incredible stories of human survival. So let's be buoyed by them.
Right. Yes, exactly. So concerning glaciers, what do you see as the way forward? Yeah. Well, I mean, and when I say glaciers, I mean, glaciers themselves are part, you know, it's the melting of the glaciers that has this sort of ripple effect. So that's the problem. But what do you see as the way forward?
Yeah, you're right. There's not like a solution for glaciers. I was surprised to read when I was thinking about where do we go next? Because, you know, in 10 years, there's so many glaciers, and they'll still be here in 10 years. But I was reading about a glacier in, I'm interested to go to a glacier in Europe that they wrap in the summer. They put, like, blankets on.
Oh, my gosh, really?
I mean, that story in itself, a long story. I don't know who does it. I don't know how insane it is. But, man, that's love. You know, that is not just necessarily for the ski industry, which it may be. But, you know, it's such a big interrelated issue. But I think, you know, everything we can do to think about how to live now in a really kind of radically different way is going to be important for glaciers and human survival. I mean, it sounds so deep, but then you have human beings going and putting some kind of covering on the glacier. So acting, right? There's good stories out there.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, for sure. And as the glaciers are one thing, I mean, I don't know how much everyone realizes, because they feel so far away. It's almost like it's in Antarctica or it's in whoever, you know, it's Patagonia. It's not going to affect me, but it is. It's going to affect everything. And so it's easy to have our blinders on, but it's just, so there's that fine line, right, between the scary and the positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would you say is something everyone can do? Just consume less generally, probably, right?
Yeah.
And
think, it may not seem radical to you, but do something kind of radical in your life, and then that kind of sparks the next thing, you know?
Truly. And I sort of digressed a little bit out of your project with Veronica, but what's the long-term aim? So it's a 10-year project. It's all about teaching climate change to kids.
Yeah, well,
right?
that's what it is now. Like, it's a really nascent stage, and I can see it evolving. Mm-hmm. It's fun to be, you know, brainstorming about what it might be now, because, you know, who knows how it'll evolve with, you know, I'm asking my daughter to commit to this with me, and she's like, when are we going? Am I going to make so-and-so's birthday? So, you know, she was a bit resentful that we were going away so soon. We're going this week to Jasper to look at the Columbia ice field. Even though it's not really open to the public in winter, I'm like, come on, Europe does it. We can do it. Iceland does it. Of course, safety's a concern. But what I think, you know, what it'll be might evolve. Maybe she'll start writing a bit about it. There's going to be no pressure. You know, I think it has to come about organically. But I think I like the idea of she's growing and they're shrinking. And what are the stories in between? And, you know, Boyhood, the movie came out, and maybe that subconsciously inspired me. But I think, you know, to go to a few continents, to go to them, as you say, so few people will. Part of it's just awareness raising.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So what will your outlet be for what you, like, is it, are you traveling to schools to sort of share what you learn, or what will the outlet
for now it's writing. Writing and visual.
You
take some pictures and I take pictures. And it'll have an element of what are the facts, because I think that's important. I'd also like to produce a map, not of our glaciers, but I think, you know, when I started looking at where am I going to go to the glaciers in Canada, I'm sure they're out there. There's so many incredible resources and things online. But I think, you know, a few tools and visuals.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll have to keep an eye out for that for sure. I'll include links in the show notes for anyone interested. So I know we're running out of time, so a few last rapid-fire questions. How can a person get involved with your initiatives or something similar?
Well, I think, you know, the Antarctic Book doesn't have an advocacy side, but a group we like and we've worked with before is called ASOC, the Antarctic Southern Ocean Coalition. I think they're worth having a look at, just if you want to get to know more about Antarctica, because it's a coalition of a whole bunch of groups, you know, interest groups that have a stake, from fishing groups to, you know, groups that are looking at, you know, well, sheer science. So that's a terrific resource to start. And I think just read up, and there's so much on the web.
Yeah, I know. After looking into it a little bit, it is getting to be more and more vast. So that's great. So did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share?
Well, no, I'm inspired that you two are using kind of multimedia approaches. I'm just grateful to be able to have this chat with you.
Oh, me too. Thank you. So what, just finally, what is the best way for an inspired listener to get in touch with you?
They can, I have my website, caroldevine.info.
Okay.
and please get to me through that, or the Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning. Yes, it's that whole long title, Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning.com.
Okay. All right. And then you're on Twitter too, right?
Yeah,
just at Carol Devine, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, I'll have links to all of this, as I said. So Carol, that was it. That concludes what I wanted to talk about. As I could probably have gone on and on, but I'm really grateful for the time that you took today. So
yeah,
thank you.
Thanks a million.
So that concludes my talk with Carol. I hope it inspired you. If you wanted to re-listen to any part of the show or look up any of the resources we talked about, you can do that at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Carol. This podcast is created by Pure Green Magazine. Go to puregreenmag.com to pick up a copy of our latest issue or to subscribe. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.